across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello, everyone. Well, my goodness. I've been talking to quite a few people from the Ulster Unionist Party, and it all goes bang today on The Nolan Show. The Stephen Nolan Show! The Nolan Show has been talking to a number of insiders within the Ulster Unionist Party about how Doug Beattie was ousted as leader. You're about to hear an interview which one of our team has voiced up. It was with a senior source who is speaking out on the Nolan Show this morning. We've spoken to multiple sources. Beattie resigned but was told by the chair to take some time and think about it. He put in that resignation letter. He did think about it and he changed his mind. And he wrote another letter saying he wanted to stay as the leader of the UUP. But the party officers refused to let him and drove him out anyway. They did that with the knowledge that the entire MLA group within the UUP supported Doug Beattie staying as the leader of the party. So there is this gap now, there is this chasm between the party officers and the MLAs on the ground who people have voted for. We can tell you this morning that it was that initial resignation letter from Doug Beattie, who some of our sources are telling us was so damning, so brutal about the party officers, that that is what infuriated them. What did Doug Beattie say? He didn't miss and hit the wall, is what I was told. And the party officers dug in, had read what they had said about some of them, and refused to budge. How does the Ulster Unionist Party go forward from here? And there is a decision for the party to make. Again, some of the sources who have been speaking to me over the last 48 hours have said that there is a decision for the party to now make. Do they drive out the party officers? Do they restart the Ulster Unionist Party? And do they say that they want a fresh look at who the party officers within the UUP should be? You will also hear suggestions in this interview that Doug Beattie, the words of the sources who are familiar with what happened in the meeting, was that there was a character assassination of Doug Beattie and he was being yelled at and screamed at within the meeting. So let's stand back from this. This is voiced by one of our team, but this is a senior source within the Ulster Unionist Party telling me how their leader was ousted. So what's the score? What happened?
So pretty much there was a fallout over a selection process. Party rules and standing orders were not followed. A lot were broke and Doug threw the head up and resigned. He was told to take a couple of days to think about it. He took a couple of days. He spoke to a lot of party colleagues and he rescinded the resignation. However, party officers decided that they didn't accept that and they wanted him to go. It was not that they did not want him to go because of how he was running the party. It was all personal. It was just an assassination attempt on his character. A meeting that took place at party headquarters about 6 weeks ago now, just an assassination attempt on his character.
Well, in what way were they assassinating him?
They were going on about how they didn't like him, they didn't want him, they were calling him arrogant. They were saying he didn't listen. Doug has always put the party first. He has never taken anything to better himself. He had the opportunity to be the health minister. He didn't take it. He had the opportunity to become a peer in the House of Lords, and he did not take it. He made sure that other people within the party got that chance before him. He is not a selfish man, and he did not deserve to be treated in the way he was.
So at the party officer meeting, this was when? About 6 weeks ago, is that right?
Roughly six weeks ago, yeah. So they were shouting at him, they were tearing strips off him. He was answering the questions as they had asked, but it just wasn't good enough. just it was nothing to do with him as leader. It was all to do with his character, and they just didn't like him, and they wanted him gone. There was specific associations within the party. Fortunately, we are governed by 17 different associations, and they all think that they are individual Ulster Unionist parties, which means when it comes to decisions being made, they all believe that they should be heard. Yes, they should, but they are not the decision-making body, and they don't see it that way. All of it was to do with the replacement of Robin Swan. Now, there was a party officer removed from the interview panel because they believed that the party officer had a conflict of interest, which was later discovered there was nothing there. But regardless, that person was removed, and that was fine. The association threatened to all resign if they did not choose who they wanted to be chosen. And yes, character assassination was carried out on one of the people who had put forward their name. They did not base it on whether the person was qualified to do the job, or loyal they had been to the party, or what they had done to the party. It was all set up that this one person got the job, and that was it. There was no discussion around it, which is a breach of party rules. And the very fact that one person who got the job was notified they got the job before party officers even ratified it was another breach of party rules. The person was notified before party officers ratified it, because it was then put into the media before party officers had even been told about it. Which is why Doug got annoyed, because not going by the rules and standing orders was pulling his integrity into question, and he refused to allow that to happen. He was angry, and he put in his resignation. He was told to think about it, and thought about it, and then rescinded it. But unfortunately, the chair had gone and told the party officers about it, and they seen this as their chance to get rid of Doug. Not because of party policies or how he was leading the party, just because they didn't like him and nobody was standing in the wings to take over. And they didn't care. Doug said, "No, I don't accept that. I've rescinded that." And they said, "Nope, we're not accepting the rescinding." And they went on and met with their MLAs, and the MLAs would not back them. All of the MLAs told them that they were making a mistake. It's been rescinded. They all just need to let it be. Let's carry on as we are. Tensions were too high, and they agreed to take 4-3 weeks, take that break, and let everybody try and calm down. And when they came back, party officers said, "Nope, we are still accepting this," and the MLAs did not back them. Whoever the new leader is when they take over, they need to be very aware that the party is not happy with the party officers, and they need a change.
But you said on this occasion, am I right in this, that this was all down, what kicked this all off, this was down to the recruitment process that started all of this off. Is that right?
Yes, because party rules and regulations were not followed. And Doug felt it was pulling his integrity as a leader into question. And when they didn't follow the rules in regards to even telling party officers what had happened, he felt he had no other option. He did have other options. He was reacting too quickly, which is why he was told to take a couple of days, and he did that. But they seen it as their opportunity just to get rid of him. It is bedlam. And I would say a lot of people don't want to go public, because we obviously need to protect our own spot within the party. But Stephen, at the same time, whoever is coming in to replace Doug needs to be put under the pressure to replace the party officers, because they are the problem. And we will not move forward from here until that is done.
Does BD want to come back?
He would come back for the good of the party. He will only ever do what is good for the party. They don't deserve him, but he would. He would do what is right for the Ulster Unionist Party, and he would come back. He has only ever done what he believes is right for the party and the people of Northern Ireland. He never puts himself first.
That's a senior source within the Ulster Unionist Party speaking to me. Another senior source telling me that the quote, and I'll quote what this source told me, they said there is a very simple thing that could happen in the next few weeks. Doug Beattie could put his name in for the leadership again if he wanted to, and it could all be done in a couple of weeks. There is nothing to stop him putting in and testing the party. And if anybody didn't want blood on the carpet, that's the way it could be done. That coming from another senior source within the Ulster Unionist Party this morning. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call. Alex Kane, who was Director of Communications for the Ulster Unionist Party, with me this morning. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Stephen.
Well, a number of people telling me that what the UUP didn't want was for this all to become public. The Ulster Unionist Party themselves this morning, we had been to them yesterday, they're refusing to comment on this. They say they do not comment on party matters. When we were talking, as you know, Alex, I'm explaining to everyone else about the selection process within that interview. Robin Swan was elected to Westminster. The party initiated then a selection process to replace him. Long-standing Ballymoney councillor Daryl Wilson failed in his bid to be selected, with the Ballymena councillor Colin Crawford chosen for the co-opt. Now, I've got to say that every single source who I spoke to yesterday were glowing about Colin Crawford and were saying that this is a good guy, is a good politician, but their problem is the rules were broken. Beattie's problem was the rules were broken, and yet it was done anyway. Alex, how much of a mess is this for the UUP?
It's a huge mess, Stephen. You need to go back. I was there, obviously, during the Trimble years, particularly after the agreement, when they were calling, and you would have covered them, you know, they were calling Ulster Unionist Council meetings, emergency meetings, basically on a monthly basis. They were calling executive meetings on a monthly basis. They were calling officer meetings on an almost daily basis because there was so much enmity. It's a lot of this in politics, Stephen. A lot of this is personal. It's about egos. It's about people who have other agendas. It's about people in some cases who don't dislike Doug personally, but dislike the direction of travel in the party. There's a lot, and also I think it's worth saying, there's two things worth saying. Firstly, in terms of the selection for Robin Swan's replacement, my gut instinct would be if Robin Swan had not agreed to that, had not been happy with that replacement, it would not have happened. So it comes with his support as well. And also I think despite the initial reaction of the party to the general election, and obviously they were very pleased to get an MP elected for the first time since 2015, when they looked at the closer figures, they realised the party hadn't done as well as was expected. And there were, if you look at South Belfast, East Belfast, other places, also North Down, the party had done much, much worse than expected. And I think there was a sense among a growing number of people, and it wasn't just party officers, Stephen. I heard this, in fact, I think I talked to you shortly after the election, I heard this from other elements of the party as well, that they were very disappointed with the result and so on. So I think you're seeing a number of things all combined together into this huge mess. And I say, you know, the party officers run, basically that is their job, to run the party. And one other thing I think...
Is there a question mark, Alex? So a number of the people who have spoken to me have said that no matter who becomes the next party leader, the whole structures within the party and who the party officers are need to be looked at and changed. And they said to me, or else no one worth their salt should take the leadership of that party. How vulnerable are the party officers here if the MLA said no, the people that were elected said no, we want Doug Beattie to stay as leader, and the party officers drove him out anyway? Are they vulnerable or not?
They're vulnerable in the sense that our processes, which could lead to, I remember it's already been talked about, votes of confidence and so on, and examination of the minutes and the executive itself could be brought in. And also they'd probably have to set up a committee, a subcommittee to look at all of this. But that's a lengthy process, and they've already kick-started the leadership process, Stephen. But the other thing I think is just worth saying here, I mean, if we've been told that every single MLA backed Doug Beattie's leadership, I have to tell you that either some of those MLAs are lying to that source, or they're lying to people like me, because I've heard some people say that it probably was time for Doug to go. And interestingly, Not one MLA so far, even though a number of them have been asked about whether they're going to stand for election, whether they're going to stand to replace Doug. Not one of them has said the words, actually, I won't be standing because I believe Doug should be the leader. He shouldn't have been forced out. I am backing. Not one of them said that, Stephen. And that in itself is interesting, I think.
Well, lying is a strong word, isn't it? There will be different interpretations of what MLAs do and don't say and people interpreting them. Certainly, the sources who have spoken to me have talked about the MLAs wanting Doug Beattie to stay. How much power do the collective of MLAs have within the Ulster Unionist Party compared to the party officers?
Well, the party officers run the party. They have run the party through the executive. So basically, the power is there. It's the party officers, then you go down to the executive, and then the governing council of the party itself. So those are the three main structures. In terms of whether the MLA group have institutional power, in essence, they don't. They don't have they exist within the constitution. They're represented. It's worth bearing in mind, Stephen, that the MLA group is represented in the party officers. You know, there is at least one MLA who's a member of that party officer team. But no, unless every single MLA was to say we are, and but also it has to go beyond that, Stephen. Unless every single member of the party who's eligible and under the rules, anyone who is in good standing in the party, that could be an MLA, councillor, MP, or ordinary member, unless every single member said, no, we are not challenging for the leadership, we will not be challenged for this, that's when real, if you like, on the ground power comes into play. You know, that would back Beattie's position would be changed unalterably if everyone said if nobody came forward to stand against him or stand. He wouldn't even need to put his own name in, Stephen. He would just, if nobody applied to be leader to replace him, that would force the party officers, that would force the executive to make huge decisions. And it would be at that point, maybe somebody would say, how did we get into this mess? How do we get to a situation where a party leader felt himself so trapped? So, I mean, what was the thing he said, that his differences had become irreconcilable? Even at David Trimble's weakest point, Stephen, even at his very weakest point, he was still able to have civil conversations with his party officers. Yes, some of them thought he should go, and it was time he did go, and maybe he should have gone a bit quicker. But he was still able to have a very civil relationship with the entirety of his officer team. That is clearly not the case now. And I don't know why that is not the case. I don't know what happened. I know Doug can be blunt. You know Doug can be blunt. But I've never seen a situation where what we've now been told is that the entire officer team is so against the leader that in essence they forced him out.
No, it wasn't the entire officer team. It's our understanding that two within the party officer team, were content with Doug Beattie staying as leader of the party.
Two out of about, I think it's 14 or something like that. You know, okay. We'll not
10. I think it is 10
parity, but yeah, it's.
But the other thing that we know is that Doug Beattie in that first resignation letter. And look, people will have that letter. I wonder, will it come to light? But that he didn't hit and miss the wall about what he thought about some of those party officers. So it's been suggested to me that one of the key questions to ask is, did the party officers get caught up in the emotion of what they had read in that first resignation letter? Because if you stand back and think about this, Alex, the chair of the party was appointed by Doug Beattie.
Uh-huh.
That person thought that Doug Beattie should have a number of days to reflect on the resignation letter. In other words, that person thought Doug Beattie should have the opportunity to rescind it. So the chair thought that, gave Doug Beattie some time to think about it. He thinks about it. He says, OK, I'll stay. But the party officers who saw that resignation letter said, no, you're out.
Well, I haven't seen the letter for that, so I think it's just worth saying that. My experience of the party officers and of the crises that the party has faced over the past 20 years or so, they are usually fairly measured. Yes, there will be anger, Stephen. I've heard anger expressed at meetings like this, but normally and usually the party officers will sometimes bury their differences simply for the good of the party, for what they believe is the right direction of the party, or the damage that losing the leader would do to the party. So I don't know. Having not seen it, I don't know what it, if the story is accurate, what it was said in that letter, what Doug said, that so angered these people. And some of these people, Stephen, are quite young. Some of these people are quite new to the game. You know, they're only elected quite recently. So I'm not quite sure. I can't help but think that there's some other agenda playing out there. And I suspect it's to do not so much, again, with the Doug personal thing. Anyone who's known Doug, anyone who's worked for Doug for the past few years. I mean, I've had my run-ins with Doug. We've always had a very civil relationship and maintained that relationship. But when Doug tells you something that he's not happy with, or he thinks he disagrees, he lets you know quite clearly. But you don't sort of call out with him immediately, you have to go. So I don't know what the breaking point was for the officers. That would be the normal thing as well, Stephen, that if you hand in a resignation, the officers would, and particularly the chairman, would say, look, we have your letter, it's been recorded, it's in the minutes. Do you want to think about it? Do you want to just take your time? Just because if you leave, it opens up the whole election thing. It opens up the whole lead. We don't really want that right now, Doug. Have a think about it. Then by the time he has to think about it, basically he's been told that we don't want, we're accepting it. Something happened in those 2 or 3 days, Stephen, and I don't know what that took. I don't know why.
Well, we're told what was written in that letter was one of the fundamental reasons why the party officers wouldn't roll back.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I have not seen the letter.
Nor have I.
Let's put it this way, Stephen. I'm pretty sure that you will have it in a matter of hours. I may even see it in a matter of hours as well, because until we know what the exact... But also, I find it extraordinary, and this is just, an observation, that if Doug put something in a letter so offensive, so anger-provoking, it makes you wonder what else was going on. And, I did ask Doug, I think I've already written about this, but it's in today's Irish Times, that I'd asked Doug on the 30th of July and sent him a letter and said, look, just clarify something for me about, the relationship of you and the officers and resignation letters and so on. And it's my understanding, blah, blah, blah. And he just replied to me, one of the three-word answers, that is not accurate, Alex, basically telling me that, the story about the anger and the irreconcilable positions were not, and that yet 3 weeks later he resigned on the basis that his relationship with the officers had become irreconcilable.
I see one of our listeners is asking, where are the party officers? Why are they not speaking publicly about what has happened? The Us Unionist Party attempting to close down on this. They've said the Us Unionist Party do not comment on internal party procedures. But if we move to the next point, this is not just about an internal party procedure. This is about the people who represent citizens in Northern Ireland. Again, a number of sources trusted by the Ulster Unionist Party have told me that they are deeply concerned with the recruitment process, and they are again saying that is one of the reasons why Doug Beattie reacted as he did and said that he would not stand over it. So you have this selection process. Ballymoney councillor Daryl Wilson, it has been suggested underscore. We have no knowledge of this, but a number of sources who we know are trusted by the UUP saying Daryl Wilson came first in an interview in the selection process, but the party officers instead chose Colin Crawford as their preferred candidate. That is not an internal party procedure. That is about who represents the people listening to this programme who support the UUP. So will the party officers have to, Alex, put into the public domain what happened and refute the allegations that Daryl Wilson was the best person for the job?
I think what they will have to do is yes, they need to go back to that, and they will have to put on paper the exact reasons for overruling. My understanding, Stephen, is, and this is just my understanding, but I think it is correct, is that party officers under the rules do have a process where they can make it. Usually some sources will give them a choice of two. They will interview people. One might come first, one might come down, whatever it is. The two names are then put to a party officer. They basically, it's a ratification process. My understanding is that the officers still retain the power for whatever reason they choose to exercise that power, Stephen, but they still retain the power. These two, we are choosing this one.
And there's no question. There's no question with that, Alex. But then there's no question with that they do have the power. But why do an interview process in the first place if ultimately they're going to choose themselves anyway? But the bigger question is, for anybody that is contemplating standing for the Ulster Unionist Party as a leader in the future. So BD did not want, again, this is our understanding, he had preferred Darrell Wilson, is what I've been told. So if you're the leader of a party and what you have said, the party officers overrule that, what might the next future leader be thinking? What power does he or her actually have?
Well, I think in a case like this, Doug should have been shown, and I don't know whether he was or not, but certainly there should be a paper trail explaining why when you have two candidates, both one of whom is the favourite in the particular group and the runner-up, there should be somewhere a paper trail which explains that why the party officers, in other words, in this case, they disagreed with the leader. They said, in our view, this candidate is preferable to the candidate who came first, because there are always reasons. When I was in the party, when I worked as director of comms, I also chaired the rules committee for a while. We know there are reasons that I won't go into and can't go into, but there are reasons why someone chosen on the ground, you know, at the local level, for a variety of reasons, will not make it through in the final choice. On that, I don't know what that is, Stephen, and we have to be very careful what we're saying here, but those are the rules. Now, I don't think those rules are going to be changed, even with this particular story.
Look at the clue that Darrell Wilson gave on the 10th of July. He was one of the candidates. He wrote on his Facebook page the following: I had put my name forward to be considered for the vacant MLA position in North Antrim, and it is with a heavy heart that I share the news of my unsuccessful bid. I am awaiting feedback from the party regarding concerns and questions that I have surrounding the process. So multiple sources telling the Nolan Show that the process was not followed. There you have Darrell Wilson. It's a little bit polite, isn't it? But he's saying concerns and questions I have surrounding the process. So he's questioning the process. And we're being told that Beattie said that it was such a challenge to his integrity, because he could not, as leader, stand over the process that was implemented. Again, how could any future leader walk into the party with that type of running, that type of mechanism, not being clarified? What was wrong with the process? What happened?
Well, I think, yes, I agree with you, Stephen. And again, I remember not similar situations, but vaguely similar situations. In a case like that, you know, if someone had come to me in my previous role in association and said, Alex, I would say, you need to write a formal letter to the party officers. You need to ask them. Set out your concerns, set out why you don't agree with them, why you think it needs to be revised, reconsidered, reversed. That, I don't know if Darrell has done that. He says he's written to somewhere asking. I don't know if he's had a reply to all of that. I don't know whether the officers just didn't bother their Barney to do anything about it. But yes, he's entitled. You are. The rules make it clear that you are entitled to go to the officers and ask why, since this candidate was the first chosen by the association or whatever it is, why did you choose a separate candidate? Please give us your reason.
Well, we asked the party. We gave the Ulster Unionist Party an opportunity to clarify what had happened. We asked them what was the nature of Darrell Wilson's questions and concerns. We asked if the UUP had communicated or met with Mr. Wilson to provide feedback on the issues, on his concerns, and they completely ducked it. They said the UUP do not comment on internal party procedures. I've got to go to the news, Alex. Just one final question. Again, another different senior source from who you heard this morning, suggesting to us that the cleanest way for this to all unravel is for Doug Beattie to put himself forward as leader in the next few weeks, and let the grassroots, the constituency associations, let the party show what support there is or isn't for him. Do you think that would be good for the UUP?
I don't think it can work, Stephen, because you have an election process over it. That only works if Doug throws his name in and nobody else puts their hat in the ring. But then he doesn't even have a mandate. You know nothing. If you have a contest, then Doug could win, but then he wins by 51-49. Or send the three candidates and Doug goes out in the first one. It's a very... I can understand what the person is saying, and I suspect, and I'm not... I don't know who they're... I suspect that their reasoning behind this would be that if Doug made it quite clear, announced today, I have decided, having talked to the party, that I will be putting my name in. I will be seeking a mandate. I will be seeking to redeem myself, blah, blah, blah. And they've got, oh, well, nobody else has done that sign, and Doug is, you know, hurrah. But the problem with that, Stephen, and I've seen it before, I've seen it happen in other elections across the Ulster in this party, it doesn't always work their gut, because it just takes one person to go, who doesn't like Doug for personal, political, whatever, says, well, actually, I'm going to stand, I'm in good standing, I'm entitled to stand, I've got the 35 nominations, which isn't very many out of a party that's over 1,000, it isn't difficult to do that, and suddenly you have a leadership election, Stephen, which will become very bitter. It'll become an election, the officers and executive versus, you know, some new... That, I think, you know, no disrespect to the person who told you that, I think that would be a catastrophic way of dealing with that.
Alex Kane, thank you. We're going to continue our coverage of this. The Nolan Show can tell you this morning that it was the resignation letter, the initial resignation letter that Doug Beattie sent in, that the party officers got sight of, that multiple sources are telling us infuriated those party officers. We'll pause for a second. Veteran Ulster Unionist, former Ulster Unionist Councillor Chris McGimsey with us this morning. Good morning to you, Chris.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. What are your thoughts?
Well, it is an absolute unmitigated disaster that the party leadership would let the situation arise like this, and then the people on the ground will have to pick up the pieces. But it's a complete disaster, and it's an indicative, I think, of the really almost an amateurish way in which the Ulster Unionist Party is ruled. When you look back to the days when I was an officer under Jim Mulnow, everything was, there was a disagreements and sometimes firm disagreements on issues. But I mean, Jim Mulnow was able to steer everything through and keep everybody on board. And we're not in that position now. So it's a complete mess. And the only loser here is going to be the Ulster Unionist Party. It's going to affect still further our ability to attract voters at the polls.
Will it affect your ability as a party to find a new leader?
Well, what obviously could happen now is Doug Beattie could put in an application to be the new leader, and nobody else stand, and therefore he automatically would be endorsed as the only candidate. I mean, that's... I suspect that's how it'll run out. But you know, Doug Beattie has indicated he would still like to stay on as leader and have a second bite at the cherry. And
but how could the party officers survive if that happened?
Well, the party, there needs to be a look at the party officers. Can I say to you with regard, I'm sorry Alex is away, because Alex will know this better as well as I do. We used to elect our party officers at the Ulster Unionist Council meeting. When I was elected to the party officers team, I think I got about 300 or 400 votes. I mean, because you had 1,200 or 1,400 people in the hall. Then Mike Nesbitt changed a lot of that. The rules were all changed to tighten it up, to give the small cadre at Glengall Street greater control, and particularly the officer greater control. The officer, the leader, should have greater control now than he ever had. And so it's less democratic, less representative, and the officer team clearly feel that they're in an impregnable position, which they are at the minute because of the rules. But it's an astonishing situation that you would have the officers behaving the way they have, and Doug behaving the way he did. He obviously wrote a letter in anger, and they have held him up. I have, like you and Alex, I haven't seen the letter. But no doubt I will see it this week sometime, because the Ulster Unionist Party leaks like a sieve, and then we'll be able to really see what on earth has been going on.
You know, we offered the party officers, we wrote to the Ulster Unionist Party, they presumably are controlled by the party officers, so we have offered the party officers an opportunity to come on, tell the public what is going on within their own party. You know, their leader, for goodness sake, tried not to leave and has been driven out anyway. And the Ulster Unionist Party are describing this as an internal matter. There's then the other aspect of, you know, the multiple sources saying the leader, the man who the Ulster Unionist Party trusted to represent them, it was so upset about the process and the breach of process recruiting someone that that was part of why he said he had to resign. And the Ulster Unionist Party describing all of that as an internal party matter. How's that not a public matter?
It is, of course, a public matter. When you're selecting someone to represent the public at the Assembly or at Westminster, I mean, of course, it's a public matter. Now, certainly, if you're taking control, if you have control of a political party, any political party, there has to be a certain amount of incommunicado discussions take place and a lot of decisions taken. I mean, you're not going to be taking every decision then putting it out into the press to be second-guessed. But, I mean, generally speaking, something as strong as this, I can't see this just simply dying because you got a letter saying, we're not prepared to talk about this, because I don't think that will go down well, and I don't think it'll go down well within the membership.
The people who are currently, and there could be others, but the people who are currently being touted as in the mix for the leader job, if Doug Beattie doesn't go for it, Mike Nesbitt, Robbie Butler, John Stewart, would any of those three people, and there may be others, throw their hat in the ring, would any of those three people be prepared to work to those party officers?
Well, any of those people, whoever takes over, whether it's Doug again or someone else, will have to work to the officers. The officers are supposed to take the soundings from the ground, both from the population generally and from the membership of the party, and views will emerge as to what policy
should be. But did they? In driving Beattie out after he tried to stay, what were the soundings from the ground? And we know that at least the majority of the MLAs wanted him to stay.
Well, we know that, yes. But, I mean, that there would be a certain collegiality amongst MLAs. And we only have nine. So you're talking about the majority, a majority of the eight who wanted him to stay. And influential, very important individuals because they're MLAs. But, I mean, the real power in the party used to be the executive committee. And the executive committee is about 100 or 120 people. But that seems to be being increasingly bypassed. And headquarters, and this is pre-Doug Beattie's time, have been trying to exert even stronger control over the entire party. And you have, as I mentioned to you yesterday, small group of people really who control the party. And what you have now is you have a party leader who has fallen out with that small group of people, and they're determined to get rid of him.
Then there's so many different angles to this, Chris. Then
yes.
the chair of the party tells Beattie that he has time to reflect on his resignation letter. In other words, the clear inference, you can rescind it. Does the chair not have any authority? Did it not matter that the chair told Beattie, you think about this?
Of course it should matter, because, I mean, if the chair made that ruling, if the officers sat back and said nothing when she made that ruling, then obviously that was the decision of the officers. So, I mean, I don't see how they can stand over ignoring the ruling that their meeting took, because the chairman said, okay, guys, listen, Doug, take a few days to think about this, come back to this. And unless there was an immediate objection, which there could have been from the officers, and it had been voted down that he wasn't given to a few days to think about this, well, then I would have thought the officers are in a very weak position there. Irrespective of what your view is on Beattie or anti-Beattie or pro-Beattie, I would have thought they're in a difficult there.
And
yes, go ahead.
You know the party.
Yeah.
What do you think the next step might be here from the grassroots within the party? Will, look, is it over for Beattie? Is he gone? And it's about a new leader now. I was also told, how can I put this? I was also told by the sources who were speaking to me that the structures within the party need to change before a new leader will go in there. And those structures were about the party officers. What's the next stage here? Is Beattie gone, do you think? Will the grassroots want answers before they will they demand answers, or will this just move on, new leader, fresh start?
Well, I think there'll be a selection meeting for a leader. The officers have already pushed that button with considerable haste. They've pushed that button. What might well happen, and what I suspect might happen, is that that Doug Beattie will apply to be reappointed as leader, and no one else will go against him. Therefore, there, when we come to the selection of a candidate, as we did with the time with McAllister and Nesbitt, that Doug Beattie would be re-elected unopposed. That's what I think. That is the neatest way to get out of this mess. But the ensure it doesn't happen again.
Well, how's that neat? Where do the party officers go? How can they continue in their positions if the majority of them refused to let Beattie stay and then Beattie's the leader? How could that relationship continue?
Well, there'll be relationship difficulties, as there are, clearly are at the minute.
Might the party officers have to go?
Well, no, the party officers... Well, the party officers will be elected, but they're mostly all selected by other bodies, and not the case. I think we need to go back to the old days where you wanted party officers, you got your 1,200 people in the hall, and democracy decided that, and that would have helped to ensure that this didn't happen.
Some of the party officers, by the way, are selected by Doug Beattie. I think it's four are selected by Doug Beattie, and now that his resignation, now that he's gone, those party officers within that party officer group, they go with him. So they're gone too.
That's my understanding as well. I think Jill McCauley, the chair, who offered Doug a few days to consider it, she was appointed by Doug. So if Doug goes as leader, she immediately, the party officers lose their chair. And as you say, there are other positions as well. So, what the party officers should be thinking now, and what the leadership of the Ulster Unionist Party generally should be thinking, how do we get out of this mess neatly? And the neat way to get out of this mess is to run the leadership. We have to run the leadership election. It's essential. Is to run the leadership election. Doug has indicated he would like to stay on. All he needs to do is send in his application form. And as long as nobody else puts in to go against him, then he'll get it.
Well, frankly, Doug had indicated he wanted to stay on. Who knows where he is now? I don't know where he is in his head now. We know that Mike Nesbitt has not ruled himself out of standing for the leadership. We also know a number of people have said to me that Robbie Butler, despite some reporting, has not ruled himself out and will make the decision very shortly as to whether he wants to be the new leader or not. So there you have Nesbitt, there you have Butler. But would they want it? Would those men want it? And any other candidate in the circumstances that you've heard?
Well, I can't see anybody wanting to take over in this position. In the situation we're in now, it's such a monumental mess up. I can't think of anybody wanting, because, whoever gets involved in this mess, it will reflect on them. And, they would hope, obviously, to have a future in Ulster Unionist politics. This could be damaging to them. So I wouldn't think I can't foresee anybody going forward as a unity candidate or anything else. I think what will happen, if Doug Beattie puts his name in, I would not be surprised, but that candidates will either withdraw or not put their names in at all. But it gets us back to the major problem, which is not Doug Beattie. It's not who's the leader in 6 months' time. It is the complete administrative mess that the Ulster Unionist Party is in. It needs to relook at its structures once again. It needs to look at the lack of representation within the party, and it needs to deal with those issues. Otherwise, something like this will turn up once again, and we'll be fighting this battle on and on, making laughingstocks of ourselves, and really all we're doing is handing further support to other political parties from people who will say, well, geez, would you vote for the Ulster Unionists? Look at the state they're in. How could they run a party, even a country, when they can't even run a party? And that's, I think, one of the major dangers. If these people are all, and I'm sure they are, all have the good of the Ulster Unionist Party at hand, they need to sit there and think, now, what do we do here to resolve this as easily as possible for the party?
Crispus MC, thank you. 030 30 80 55 55. Gareth, morning, Gareth.
Hello, Stephen. Many of us are very fond of Doug Beattie, as we have seen and heard over the last day or two. But the problem is inconsistency. And the question has to be, where is that inconsistency in the Ulster Unionist Party? Is it with the officers? Or has it been with Doug Beattie? Or is Doug Beattie just being reactive, which is part of his personality, to the inconsistencies of the officers? And are the officers simply men in grey suits with bowler hats? Because if they are, then they need to get rid of them. Otherwise,
there are a number of women who certainly were party officers.
Well, they need to get rid of them if they're going to hold them back. Because what is the brief of the Ulster Unionist Party? If they have consistency, then they have to stick to their brief. And many of us thought that Union of People, which was launched in 2022 with their glossy video, was the brief of the party to modernise. Do they want to modernise or not? If they don't want to modernise, then what is the point in them remaining in existence if they're actually trying to broaden the appeal of unionism? And then that raises the next question. Is it not better for them actually to help the DUP? Okay. And maybe is it time for the old Paisley Party to go, the old official Unionist Party to go, and for them actually to try and combine the best of each of them with a brand new party for the 21st century, Stephen?
Gareth, thank you very much indeed. While the Ulster Unionist Party, their position is they don't comment on internal party procedures, there are a number of questions that people from within their own party are asking me to raise publicly. First of all, does the Ulster Unionist Party dispute and can it refute that its leader at the time, the person they trusted, Doug Beattie, had major concerns about the processes with which Colin Crawford was appointed as the preferred candidate? Does the Ulster Unionist Party have any comment about their former leader's position, as multiple sources have told me, that he thought the processes were so flawed and were so against party rules that he could not remain in the party? That was the reason, one of the reasons for that initial resignation letter. Does the Ulster Unionist Party think they can keep that chasm of claim and counterclaim private? What did go on in the process between the selection between Colin Crawford and Darrell Wilson? Secondly, is Doug Beattie going to put his hat in the ring? Is he going to fight to be the next leader of the Ulster Unionist Party? Thirdly, how strong or how precarious is the position of some of those party officers now? And the MLAs, how can they come on radio TV programmes and speak publicly about any social issue if and not be asked, did you want your leader to stay? And what do you think of the party officers not letting the leader stay? And those are the questions which remain in the public domain this morning. Now, next, the search is continuing for the six people who are missing after a super yacht sank off the coast of Sicily on Monday when it was hit by a tornado. Among those missing, Jonathan Bloomer, the chairman of the investment bank Morgan Stanley. Bethany Bell is in Sicily. Good morning to you, Bethany. What's the latest?
Well, divers for a third day.
It was hit by a tornado like water spout. Sorry to contradict, to interject, Bethany. You get that right.
Yes, well, the rescue workers are, for the third day, divers are going down to the wreck, which is 50 metres underwater, 160 feet down, trying to locate the six missing people. And it's extremely complicated work, we've been told. It takes them about a minute to get down there. It's very deep. And then they can spend 8 to 10 minutes down there before they have to resurface. And the boat is lying on its side, which means that access inside it is quite complicated. There's a lot of debris, which is making things very difficult for the rescue teams. But they continue to do this, and they're using what they call remote control vehicles, which can get in and stay down on the seabed for much longer. And they're hoping today, they say they've made a breach into the side of the yacht, that they're hoping they can get into the cabin, which is where these missing people may have been.
And the family members of those missing, it's a they've been missing for a long time. Is this now a situation, Bethany, where it's about finding bodies?
It's a very... I mean, all of the rescue workers know that the longer this goes on for, the smaller the chances are of finding people alive. But in the words of one rescue worker, he said, never say never, and that they will continue to search until they have located the six missing people. But of course, with every single hour, hopes are fading to find these people still alive.
And very briefly, are we clearer on how the boat sank?
It's really many, many questions still being asked about this. Some people have said, was it the height of the mast, an extremely high mast? Others have said, were the hatches perhaps open? And this will be the subject of a lot of investigation. And for now, you know, a lot of this is secrets. It's down at the bottom of the sea. People will have to question the captain. It's a very complicated question. For now, the focus is on finding the missing.
Bethany Bell, thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Don't forget, if you've got a story, nolan@bbc.co.uk. When an issue happens in the local community, we often get more and more of you reacting to what you've heard. And that is exactly what has happened after our initial broadcasting about Roseland Cemetery and the state of some of the areas within it. James had contacted the programme after he visited his grandparents' grave in Roselawn at the weekend, and he was left angry by the state of the grounds surrounding gravestones.
When I went up and seen the absolute state of Roselawn, in that it was unkept grass. The grass that they did cut, they'd left the cuttings there, and the weeds between the headstones, or the height of the headstones, it's just really very disrespectful. When I looked at right across the graveyard, it was the exact same story. To be honest with you, Stephen, when I described it to other people, it looked as if it had been left for years, hadn't been kept at all. My grandparents have been in that grave for 30, 40 years, and over the time, there has been a number of changes in terms of they've taken out paths, have put in stone paths, have taken out paths. You know, it's always been changes, but never been in a positive way, and nothing's been said. But what I witnessed on Saturday, the place is an absolute sight. The management of the cemetery should hang their heads in shame if they think that it's respectable to leave gravesides in that state. Is an absolute disgrace.
Well, I've been speaking to Eric, who contacted the Nolan Show. Eric had also been up at Roselawn and saw what he thought was unacceptable scenes.
Stephen, this has been ongoing with Roselawn over the past couple of years. It's in a terrible state. Weeds that are nearly the height of the headstones, grass cuttings land on the path, even on the downslopes and the inclines, down to the gravesides, water levels land around the graves actually starting to sink because of the state of the place. And they don't seem to be doing anything about it.
Sink? I've heard of... Jim Rogers was talking about land sinking the other day.
Yeah. Last year they had on the entrance in the Roselawn, the graves on the right hand side on the low levels were actually, the area was all taped off because they had to replace and repair headstones were sinking into the graves.
My goodness. And is that close to where you have a loved one?
It's not my love. My family are on the other side in Section V, on the low side on the left hand side
that
of the
like?
Grave cemetery. Terrible. No gravel on the path. You would actually need Wellington boots or some sort of boots to walk up on a wet day. The weeds are almost at the height of the headstones. And
oh, come
grass,
on.
Grass
they've left it
cut.
That bad, have they?
It's shocking. I mean, I forwarded photographs to yourselves yesterday. It's shocking, and they do nothing about it.
Hold on, Dave.
They just seem to be able to sit on lawnmowers and cut grass and don't do anything else.
Hold on, Dave. Look close up. Oh, my goodness, I can see this now.
Yeah.
Look, there's photographs there with the weeds halfway up the headstone, I think is fair. Right, and that's for... Well, there's a taller one there. And that's for people you love. That's the level of disrespect that it seems to be, and certainly in your eyes, right?
They don't seem to have any respect for relatives or for the deceased at all in a cemetery. I mean, when you're walking up through the cemetery to replace flowers and you can see other graves that have had wreaths laid on them at Christmas and the wreaths are dead and they're still there in the middle of the summer and they haven't tidied it up, it's not really good enough.
Have you asked questions?
I have been in touch with the council on numerous occasions about it, and they say, oh, we'll get it sorted. Short term, they did replace gravel on some of the paths. They give us a spiel about they weren't able to use certain types of weed killer at certain times of year, and it was hard to keep it under control. And short term, it was fine. 3 or 4 weeks later, it was just back to normal.
Do you know what? If they can't handle it, if they can't keep it to the point where people who are grieving for their loved ones feel so upset about it, then maybe they should get somebody else in that can do it.
They should get somebody else in or else get their staff retrained, because, I mean, I was at the cemetery not that long ago and attending my parents' grave, and there was a gentleman on his hands and knees at the next grave. He was 80 years of age and he was trying to remove tall weeds from around his wife's grave that just passed recently. It's not good enough.
And the trauma, the psychological effect, that it's hard enough losing someone who you love, but then seeing them treated like this.
Exactly. I mean, my mother passed just over 2 years ago, and on the day of her funeral, the undertakers were fantastic. The cemetery staff had to lay 8x4 sheets of plywood from the path to the graveside because the path was that bad a state you couldn't walk on it, and had to wheel my mother to the graveside.
The statement says that they've given to the Nolan Show, council has listened to the feedback raised by families and loved ones in relation to the current condition of some areas in Roselawn. We are sorry for the upset caused. Work has been ongoing throughout the summer to ensure the cemetery is maintained to a satisfactory standard, including recent weed control treatment across the 268-acre site, grass cutting and weed removal. As part of our autumn work programme, our team will be improving the older gravel paths with stone chippings and looking at options to improve the presentation of paths nearest to gravesites.
Hasn't been done up to now. I mean, I sent those photographs yesterday and they were taken yesterday. So the weeds obviously haven't been under control and they're not treating them.
Like the question that remains unanswered, why did they let it get to this stage? Why?
Why? I don't know, Stephen, beyond me. They put gravel down on the past gravel chippings, which weeds and grass grow through in a short period of time. It would be more beneficial if they would just take the bull by the horns and concrete the paths. And that would not solve the problem, but it would certainly cure it for a while.
Can you go up there and work around your headstone yourself, or do they restrict you on what you can do yourself?
No, you can work at the headstone yourself. You can tidy it up, you can take weeds out if you wish to do that, and clean the headstone, replace flowers. I personally go up on the odd occasion with a strimmer and cut the grass myself, if they haven't cut it. But in relation to everything else, they just let you maintain it yourself.
And how does it make you feel about your mum and respect for your mum?
I don't think there's any respect there for any of my relatives or anybody else's relatives who are buried in Roselawn. There isn't a scene of any respect at all. I mean, in relation to the weeds that we're talking about, and you've seen the photographs, there's actually a part of Section V where there's a weed that's got that big. It looks like a small tree, and it actually engulfs half the headstone. It's been like that for 2 years, and they haven't done anything about that either.
Goodness sake. You know,
simple maintenance would, or respect, simple maintenance would cut the grass. If you see the weed, pull them out. You know, an 80-year-old man shouldn't be pulling weeds out. Of his wife's grave.
We need to find out what the actual problem is. That's what we need to find out. They're saying sorry. You know, they're listening to feedback. Well, they've known this. They must. They've got staff up there, for goodness sake. They've got the feedback. They've known it's been there.
They have, and they give you a wee quick spiel. Oh, we're sorry. We'll do this. We'll do that. They don't do it, or they do it very short term to keep you quiet and bring you back up again. Let's see what they've done. But a month or 2 months later, it's back to normal. I've been arguing with them for 2 years over this.
What do you say to them?
You know, I just simply say to them, you know, what are the chances of you replacing the paths, keeping the grass tidy, lift the grass cuttings, and control the weeds? That's all we're asking them to do, and they didn't seem to be doing anything about it.
Thank you for talking to us today, Eric. Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Okay, thanks, Stephen.
Right, let's come back to the politics. Our top story today, it is that the Nolan Show understands that party officers were left within the US Unionist Party were left infuriated when they got sight of the Doug Beattie resignation letter, and that anger within the party officer group Doug Beattie detected, we're told. Doug Beattie had asked to rescind his resignation, and the party officers refused to do so. We understand that two people within the party officer group were content with Doug Beattie staying, the entire MLA group. We are told that there is no evidence of anybody who wanted to join with the party officers in ousting Doug Beattie. John's in Portrush. Good morning, John.
This sounds to me, Stephen, like a remnant from the past Unionist Party. Doug Beattie is progressive. Doug Beattie has laid his life on the line in the Middle East. He has fought, and he has been an officer to Catholics and Protestants, and he is the fairest man that I know in his position. I think he's doing a great job because he's not yes, sir, no, sir type of person. The people attack him. This modern society attack him.
They've simply taken a decision, and they could argue, very strongly argue, John, that Doug Beattie wrote the resignation letter. He should, as a leader, not have put pen to paper until he was sure he wanted to go. We also don't know about what was said within that meeting. We don't know about the policy reasons that the party officers may feel that they had.
The wife's on her way in, Stephen. I'm sorry, I have to stop you there. All I'm saying is, he's not a man who'll toe the line for anybody. He's a man that's seen it and done it all. And he's the best Unionist leader we've had in a long time.
Well, let me ask you a different question. Here's the different question. Doug Beattie has fought in wars. So, look, should he fight here for the leadership? Should he put his hat in the ring? Or because he wrote the letter, should he bow out now and never come back as leader?
Well obviously there's disagreements in the party, and I think because he won't toe the line. But, Steve, listen, I have to go.
Okay. All right.
Have a nice day, what's left.
Thank
Bye.
You, John. What's left of it? It's only 10:15. I have a lot to do today. Joe, good morning, Joe.
Morning, Steve. This could be the final opportunity to get one Unionist Party. And you talk to any sensible Unionist in the province, and they will say, we require one Unionist Party. Now, Jim Ellis is not going to ever be part of that unity. But this is the final opportunity and the ideal opportunity to take to get the DUP and the UUP together. Now, I can understand the last 2 days of the UUP, Jeffrey Donaldson and Ari Foster.
We're both far away. My mic's on here.
Are you okay?
Yes, I am. Go ahead.
I say the last two leaders of the regions, DUP, were former members of the UUP, so I can understand the resentment within the UUP regarding that that reality. But I do, and talk to any sensible unionist, and they will say we're going nowhere until we get one party.
Well, would the UUP get gobbled up?
No,
in a one-party situation, no, would they be forgotten about in a year or two, and it would simply be the DUP?
No, no, they would get a new name and get the two of them together and form one party, Stephen. Stephen, to be quite honest, any sensible unionist will tell you we're going nowhere while we have this division between the DUP and UUP.
The division we're talking about today is within the UUP itself.
The UUP, and that's the credit evidence. I've been voting for them for, I'm 84 now, and I mean, they've lost the plot. And until they realise the reality of where we're at, the unionists, until they get together to talk with the DUP and form a party and give it a new name. Don't call it DUP or UUP.
How long have you been voting for the Aussie Unionist Party?
Well, I'm 84. So, I mean, it's since a wee boy in Harryville all those years ago.
So do you know who the Ulster Unionist Party officers are?
No.
Do you know what they stand for in terms of the direction they want to take the party in?
Stephen, they're faceless men. This is the point. These men are...
Well, they're men and women in the UUP.
Well, faceless people, that's personalities to make the best word to use. But regardless of all those said issues, Stephen, the real... And you talk to any sensible unionist and they will tell you we're going nowhere until we get one party. Anybody, even uneducated unionists, they will tell you whenever the two parties try to cut the tie with each other, until that stops and we get one party with a new name. I'm not prepared to get a new name. You call it over the lake.
Okay.
We need, Stephen, take your time to call.
Joe, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Now, next, should more businesses change to a four-day working week? The Irish News were reporting this week that a Lisburn firm, which introduced a four-day working week without cutting staff salaries, believe it now has a competitive edge in attracting new talent. As soon as the Nolan Show hear this item being read out right now, I can hear them now. They'll want to go down to a one-day week. Conveyor belt and rubber parts manufacturer Smiley Munro introduced the change at its Lisburn production facilities more than a year ago. This comes as the UK campaign group 4-Day Week prepares to launch its second 4-Day Working Week pilot in November. First pilot in 2022 resulted in 90% of participating firms choosing to implement the policy permanently. This is interesting. Businessman Max Macken is with us today. Good morning, Max.
Hi, Stephen.
Good morning. And the commentator, Phil Kelly. Morning, Phil.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Well, look, maybe it all comes down to the numbers, Max, and if people are more productive, why wouldn't you do it?
Do you know, if they sort of make conveyor belts, I was wondering, do they do shift and do they sort of like work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and finish on Friday, or work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and finish on Friday? Do they cut a whole day out? Because the thing about me is, I don't want to sound old-fashioned or anything, but when people say you're going to be more productive, that's 52 days a year less in the business your staff are at, which is 2.5 business months or 10.5 weeks. And any business that I know that can shut down or stop production for 10.5 weeks or 2.5 months just cannot turn around and say we're more profitable or we're more productive. It just doesn't work.
But why would they do it? If they're not more profitable, if they're not more productive, at the end of the day, businesses are driven by profit. So they ain't going to let staff go down to a four-day week, haven't tried it, unless the proof is in the pudding, Max.
Well, maybe sort of they're doing 10-hour days. Maybe they're still doing a 40-hour week and they're doing 10-hour days. If you're making conveyor belts and you sort of like extend your working day for another 2 hours or 3 hours, and then you're able to hit the target you're able to hit for your numbers per week, that's a way of doing it. But what I mean is, it simply sort of reduce it from a 37 or 38-hour week down to 30 or 32-hour week. Just doesn't make sense. And that's, people say to me, look, but you can't be more productive, you can't be more profitable. I kind of think, well, were you not doing your job properly when you were working a five-day week?
Phil?
Well, Max describes himself as old-fashioned. In many ways, I suppose his reaction to this is because it goes against what we're seeing of a current trend of trials, not just within Northern Ireland, but across the UK and across Europe. But the current model, if you think about it, is creating overwork and underemployment. And basically in 2022, there was 61 UK organisations who took part in a trial. 54, that's 89% of those organisations are still operating it, and 51% of them made it permanent. So what they saw was an increase in staff well-being, reduced staff turnover, and not a drop in productivity because staff weren't burnt out.
Why couldn't they be even more productive if they do a five-day week at the same level of energy and performance?
Yeah, because you're burning people out that way. And basically, Stephen, remember this. These things used to
burning
be on a
people out asking them to work 5 days a week. There are people listening
that's
to this programme.
That's just a ridiculous statement. After 5 days, people
Can I just address that? Because we've discussed this topic before and this came up, this kind of sneering attitude. Remember this, people don't just exist when they go into work for a shift. These people go home to families. They may have children who are special and complex needs. They may get a carer for an elderly relative. Now, we as a society can imagine a better system than just working people into the ground. So remember, it used to be unimaginable that children didn't work in factories. It used to be unimaginable that people could have a paid weekend. It used to be unimaginable that people could have paid sick leave. Working people fought for these rights. And what we're saying is the benefits of having people not working every single day and just to make ends meet, but actually giving them free time.
But they don't work every single day if they have weekends off, do they?
Yeah, but Stephen, society benefits when people's work-life balance is addressed, and at the minute we have a way of working that doesn't do that. So let's reimagine things.
It's time when you talk, Phil, when you talk about people who would work 5 days a week burning out, do you not think the people who have two and three jobs in this country and are working 6 and 7 days a week and are going from one job, 9 to 5 job, whatever it is, to then having to work night times to pay the bills? We'll be thinking you're having a laugh talking about burnout.
Well, burnout, Stephen,
for a 5 day standard week.
Stephen, you know that I come on your show regularly, and you know that one of the things that I would be passionate about is that we end this exploitation of workers, where workers are having to work 2 to 3 jobs to make ends meet, to not even make ends meet in some cases. We need to get away from this in work poverty, where people get up every morning, go out and earn poverty. We need a better system where people are paid properly, have proper terms and conditions in the workplace, and have a life-work balance that benefits everyone in society, because then the social industries benefit when people have time off and they've time to spend with their families. It benefits the overall economy. It's a no-brainer.
Here's Neil and Maura. Morning, Neil.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
That guy, Phil Kelly, he would make me quite angry. He's talking about...
Well, he's on the line. Say good morning to him.
Good morning, Phil.
I make everybody hard today. Don't worry about that. Yeah, I'm actually...
Well, if you want to come down here, I work 7 days a week on my farm, like loads of other farmers. To hear you talking about people burning out in 5 days a week is absolute nonsense. Pull yourself together and do a bit of work.
Well, I mean, that's not an argument, this idea that everyone should just work every day of the week, every day of the year is absurd. Let's imagine a better society where there's a proper balance.
What time do you get up on the morning?
Who feeds my cows if I don't work Saturday and Sunday? Who does that? Will let the cows starve all weekend just because you want a soft time? I start at 5:30 in the morning. Last night I finished at 8:30.
Many days a week do you do that?
I do it at least 5. Saturday I would do 5:30 till lunchtime and then back again in the evening. Sunday I would do till about 10:30.
Well, what type of life is that?
In the evening. Well, I have someone that works for me sometimes, but it's necessary. It's what I have to do.
Well, would you not want other people and maybe yourself, if you could, to be protected? That, look, it's about work-life balance, isn't it?
Yeah, but that'd be very nice, but you pay the bills. You try being a dairy farmer nowadays, and the little we get for milk, it's tough enough without having to pay somebody 14 or 15 pounds an hour to come and do work.
The BBC, before I knew how to say no to the BBC in my early days in this organisation, the BBC sent me down and made me stick my hand up a cow, and I have been traumatised ever since. absolutely. This is on YouTube.
Wouldn't have done you a bit of harm.
Oh, no, I was sick. It's on YouTube. I was sick. Couldn't go anywhere near a farm again, never mind the Irish. Thank you, Neil.
That's a nonsense, that burnout in 5 days. I would love to work 5 days a week. Just
Robert's in East Belfast. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. Good morning, Stephen. That's ludicrous for somebody to say a 4 day week. Try and tell that the taxi drivers are working 12, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's not enough hours in the day and days in the week for taxi drivers to survive. You know, and for somebody to come on to say, like, a 4 day week, it's impossible for taxi drivers, Stephen.
Phil?
We're under immense pressure. Well, again, I know you can work 7 days a week and you're going to have a middle of the year for it. The taxi drivers can't even survive.
This isn't an argument. This is someone accepting that we live in a low-pay society and saying, oh, we just need to work more hours to make ends meet. What people are saying is we need to shift the balance. We need employment that pays proper wages that people can live on with proper terms and conditions and a work-life balance. Coming on the radio and saying, I can't make ends meet and I need more hours in a day to earn more money is not...
Max, Mackin, the final word to you.
What's been proposed.
Hello. I just think, sort of, the main thing at the minute is the economy. Working a 3 day, 4 day, 2 day week's probably not going to solve that. You can see the waiting list for NHS, waiting list for dentists, waiting list even for MOT. There's a huge backlog. So doing less hours, I don't think it's going to make people more productive. I think it's going to make people less productive.
Max and Phil, we could have gone on with this, but we're out of time this morning. Just remember, everyone, I work a 7 day week. I know the violins will probably not be out, but 7 days a week. Five Live on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday night, and in here, Monday to Friday. And we'll see you tomorrow again in here at 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening today. Have a good day, everyone, and thank you.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.